I'm a grateful believer in Jesus Christ, who is finding victory over sexual addiction, the effects of domestic violence, and I'm struggling with codependency. My name is Karen. I'm the oldest of four children born in a six-year time span to a father who taught music in school and a mother who was a dietitian. We lived in rural eastern Washington until I was eight. Then we moved to Spokane. My parents tried to live off my dad's income, but school districts often cut their music program first when budgets were tough. My dad was often unemployed. My mother was a full-time homemaker, but after my kid sister was born, Mom left us to go back to college for a refresher course and went to work in the evenings and weekends. She became a director in a hospital. I saw how much she enjoyed working and how little she enjoyed parenting. I was very grateful that my dad stepped up to help with parenting chores, and we worked pretty well together, but I was still a mother junior. In grade school, my mother would be overwhelmed, and I'd go see my grandmother. She was attention-seeking, and I gave her love like a second daughter, as my mother was her only child. She was bigoted and racist, and as an adult, I've had to unlearn many things she taught me. Her home was full of books, and it was there that I began to explore the world and also start my sex education. At that time, it was considered acceptable that National Geographic had multiple photos of naked people from third world countries. I spent hours looking at them. My grandfather was an alcoholic, quiet, always smelled of Listerine, which I didn't know at the time he was drinking because it was 20% alcohol. He died of an apparent suicide when I was in ninth grade. I was the only one of the children to go to his funeral. I missed my mother and became a candy striper in a hospital to be near her. She was very smart, and I tried to role model her and worked hard in school. As the firstborn, I got a lot of attention. I was the one with braces and contact lenses, etc., that my parents couldn't afford for the others. Our school had several career paths. I loved music and played flute like my dad, but my dad was unemployed. I intentionally had my last hurrah in music in ninth grade, participating in every band and choir available. I also joined the honors program, which was a godsend because I was so bored and had been skipping school. My mother was employed with a good job, so in 10th grade, I started the math science track and gave up all music. Several things happened along the way that have impacted me to this day. We had moved into a new house, and although my room had curtains, we did not know they were worthless at night when the lights were on. Our house faced an unused field, and we felt protected. A boy saw a silhouette of my undressing. He telephoned me and said things that frightened me, as I had no idea what they meant. He asked me to join him in an abandoned house nearby. I tried to tell my parents about the phone call, and I had to have new curtains. They told me I was overreacting, and they would get to it. I felt betrayed that my parents were not protecting me. The boy assaulted somebody else and went to juvenile detention. When I was 13, I was diagnosed with scoliosis or spine curvature. By the age of 14, I needed to wear a hefty back brace, which I was in until I went to college, 23 hours a day, every day. It had a leather girdle, three steel bars, a neck ring, and a chin plate. I was a sight to behold. To make the brace, a body cast had to be made. My mother was at work, so my dad went with me. He stayed in the waiting room. I was a pubescent girl with only underpants on while two adult men were staring at me while making the cast. I felt betrayed and helpless, although I never told my parents. When I was 15, I went by bus to a high school church, a not Christian, retreat for youth leadership. I was accompanied by two boys who were 16. They sat together behind me. I sat next to a grunge guy who was in his late 20s, and I was molested while the boys who were supposed to be my escorts laughed. I felt betrayed, ashamed, and confused. Confused because I had somewhat enjoyed it, even though I knew it was wrong, and I told no one. When I was 18, I was at a church camp and met a girl. Up to this point, guys had always hurt me or let me down. My parents were busy and distant. I snuggled into the arms of this girl and felt at home. Thankfully, it was the last day of camp, and we lost touch over time. In college, I was desperate to find a man and be, quote-unquote, normal. Still to this day, I don't know what my dad meant, but he once told me I would never make a man happy. was very much like my mother, and I thought they were happy. Anyway, many of my classes in the freshman year of college were a repeat of high school, so I suddenly spent a lot of time dating, which I had not done in high school. I settled on a guy who I thought was the man of my dreams. He loved the outdoors, didn't care that much about grades, liked to party, and had lots of friends. He was everything I wasn't. I went to bed with him within a week after making my decision. I am sure that he felt trapped, as marriage after college was my expectation. There were many warning signs that I ignored about how he took care of me, or didn't, how he preferred his friends over me, and how he treated me. But I had pushed for sex and felt I deserved a lot of this treatment for that decision. We married and moved to Oregon. He eventually took a job in forestry traveling the Oregon coast. I took a hospital job in Portland. Often worked 16-hour shifts every other day, 3 p.m. to 7 a.m. I was lonely and depressed. I spent more days of our first year of marriage alone than with him. My mother had breast cancer, which she successfully hid from everyone until the last 2 years of her life. She wanted me with her, and I helped with many of the medical procedures in an attempt to save her life. I was both her daughter and her nurse. We finally made a decision to stop and took her home to Spokane, and she died 2 weeks later, a week after her 50th birthday. I was 23. My siblings were 22, 19, and 17. I, the nurse, could not save my mother, and I started drinking. Within 2 years, I was drinking almost daily, and it was starting to affect my work. I would do self-punishment things like buying wine high in histamines, hoping that the allergic reaction that followed would prompt me to stop, but it didn't. My marriage was awful, but I was afraid of being alone and self-supporting. Who was I kidding? He was unemployed so much that I was supporting myself anyway. But having worked so hard to become a nurse and make good money, my childhood dream, yet here I was risking everything for booze. I did stop drinking, but that only meant I was a dry drunk. I needed something else. That something else could have been Jesus Christ. I heard the gospel at age 25, a year after my mother died. I was looking because everything I had believed in before she died didn't seem logical or rational anymore. I accepted Jesus, but did not make him the Lord of my life at that time. That would be many years later. Instead, I tried to substitute food, which was the go-to thing for much of my family. But as I put on weight, I realized I could not keep that a secret. Besides, I needed something more intense than food gave me. I had a strong desire to try to make my marriage work, so I joined my husband in his porn addiction and acting out. It was enticing and revolting, a dichotomy that I learned to rationalize for at least 30 more years. As I continued to be more successful professionally and my husband went from job to job, the violence in our marriage increased. It started with angry and demeaning words, then holes in the wall and broken antique furniture, then to pushing and shoving. I lied about how I was injured after being pushed down a flight of stairs while leaving for work. In a work safety class, we were issued tear gas. In all my years of nursing and home health nursing and going into many unsafe neighborhoods at night, I have never needed to use it. But one day, my husband was trying to kill me in our bed, and I reached over into the nightstand and got it and sprayed him with it. We went into counseling. Things seemed to change. I delayed starting our family because I didn't want children exposed to this mess, but I was 34 and ready. He thought he was ready and willing to stay home and raise the family. Financially, that would have been great. A lot of dads stay home. Our son was born in December of 1990, and we were off, or so I tried to convince myself. The truth is that the violence restarted. I was slugged in the belly when I was 5 months pregnant with our son. He was usually very active, but did not move for a day. I went down to the emergency room, borrowed the fetal Doppler, and found the reassuring heartbeat. I was too ashamed and told no one, not even my OB, who is a trusted physician colleague. Life was on and off again. The delivery had multiple complications, and my son developed attention deficit. We made it through 4 years, and I swore I would never have another child. My work had become my addiction, along with my acting out, and I came home for my son's sake, but would do whatever I could to avoid my husband, whose life was consumed by porn, anger, and hate. I was drawing closer to God at this point and attempting to go to church and Bible study when my husband would permit it. God tapped me and asked me to have another child. I wanted to say no. At this point in our marriage, it would have almost needed a virgin birth. I was 38. I was obedient and was pregnant on a one-night event with my husband, almost unheard of at my age. My husband went back to porn, but I didn't care. My daughter was born safely without complications, and both my children are joys in my life. Having my daughter was my first big act of obedience to God. One day I came home from a long night at work and wanted to go to church. My husband did not have the children ready, but I was nursing, so he agreed I could take my daughter, who was 9 months. In my fatigue, I rode the car off the embankment at the back of this church. It's since been repaired. My daughter was strapped in her car seat, unhurt. One of the church custodians apologized for there being no barrier by the embankment, got a truck with a winch, pulled me out, and I got into church in time for the sermon. The Lord said to me, "Not all men are like your husband," and I thought I'd been helped by an angel. It was a blessing not to have my son with me. He was 5 and he would have told. My husband would have beat me to a pulp, and the church and the car would have been off limits. When my children were 4 and 8, I had to have knee surgery. I tore my knee tripping in a hole in the ground, walking home from the bus stop after a long day's work. My husband had sold his car and spent the proceeds on himself. We had one car, which he had for the kids. He rarely let me drive. I was a prisoner in my own home, only allowed to go to work. In the time off after surgery, I could see how he really was caring for the kids, and I was upset at his mistreatment, mostly negligence. He, as a man of the house, was handling the budget, and I made good money, but there wasn't much food, school supplies, and the bills weren't getting paid. During this time, the last assault happened. We had been arguing, and my son had cranked up the TV to drown us out, and my daughter was sitting next to him in the living room. Thankfully, they could not see their dad and me in the hallway. I screamed for my son to call the police, but he did not hear me. As I was passing out, my husband suddenly let go, and I believe the Lord himself intervened, or I would have died. I waited for things to settle down, locked my children with me in a bedroom, and called the police. This was 1999. I'm thankful the police now know a whole lot more about domestic violence than they did then. They asked questions that made me wonder why I'd even bothered to call them. Like, why did you wait until 10 p.m. to call if this happened at 6:30? Why don't you have any bruises? I was loaded with anti-inflammatory medicine because of the surgery, so I didn't bruise until the next day. My husband left the house overnight. He came back the next morning as I had to go to work and had no child care. The next month was a cat and mouse game of getting a restraining order and lying about where I was, seeing an attorney, making people swear at work that if my husband called to tell him I was with patients, even though I might have been at the courthouse. I had to buy a car so that when the restraining order was served, he had a way of leaving. It was a very dangerous time, but I was determined not to leave my children whom I loved and not to leave the home on which I was making payments. We were divorced and I descended to a black pit of feeling rejection and despair. There was next to no child support as my husband was unemployed. I now had to figure out child care for 2 kids 4 years apart, in age with very different needs, and often had 3 or 4 different providers in the course of a day. It was craziness and expensive. Most months, child care cost more than my house payment. I knew God was there, but I had not understood how to make him Lord of my life. I believed I was saved, but that seemed like an assurance of heaven, but not helpful for the here and now. I turned to my addiction that I could keep the most secret and seemingly would have the least effect on my work or family. That was porn and acting out by myself. Men had previously hurt me or let me down, so I falsely believed that would never happen with women, and same-sex porn is where I turned. I started leading a double life and wrestling with the devil. I would yell at my kids to get into bed so I could do my thing in the family room where the computer was. My son would come looking for me, and I'm sure he was aware of what I was doing. I stopped touching or hugging any woman in real life, as I was fearful they would show up in my fantasy life. I read pornographic stories of sex and love in an attempt to fill the emptiness in me. But it was all an illusion. I planned ahead for my addiction. I would take time off work for my addiction. I would send my kids to daycare for my addiction. I became sick of who I was and what I had become. For some reason, about 13 years ago, I walked into this Celebrate Recovery that met in the back room then on Friday nights. The first song I remember was Amazing Love. The lyrics talk about being alive and well due to God's amazing love. I was not alive and well. I was sick and dead inside. I sat in the back table and sobbed for about 3 months while Jesus started his healing work in me. I went to the codependent group in the beginning. Then others started sharing about their porn addiction, and I started to admit to myself that I had a cancer on my soul. Testimonies are so important. That was a wake-up call for me. I got into step study and started becoming honest with other women about what I was doing. A brave woman volunteered to be my accountability partner. She called me on my porn addiction, reminding me that the pictures were real people, somebody's daughter or mother or sister. She helped me realize how big my denial was, and I began to let Jesus take over my life. I completed step study and then led a step study, and I also led the women's addiction group for a time. In the middle of the second step study, pride began to rear its ugly head, and I was white-knuckling to the finish. I should have had a sponsor, but I didn't. I believed I didn't need one for some reason. After 2 years of sobriety, I told God that he wasn't enough, that my physical cravings were not being met, and I was angry at God for the drives I had. How could a God who loves me make me this way, I thought. I did not want to admit that the cravings were because I had abused sex. I left CR and went back to acting out, although not with porn. I made a lot of rules for my behavior, so I thought I was safe. But the cancer was still there. My kids grew and left home. I paid off a bankruptcy, had a different job, all seemed to be going well. Then one day someone shouted at me in public about something that was not even in the context of the situation, and it was embarrassing. I was shocked at my own behavior, behaving like a wounded animal in the corner, and realized that after all these years I had not faced the domestic violence in my life. I was in denial that the violence really happened to me, that I was the patient and not the nurse. I came back to CR to deal with that. I wanted to do things differently this time in CR. I was willing to submit to the process rather than boast about having been here before. I went to 101, the newcomers class. I prayed about which group I should be in. I started helping out in the kitchen. I joined the women's prayer team. I began to feel like I belonged here. After being here 6 months, I signed up for the women's step study. The leaders asked some getting-to-know-you kind of questions. She asked, what do you do to soothe yourself? And I thought, oh my, do I have to talk about that? I told God that we already had this conversation. And I felt like I would always need my behavior, and I told him. In reflecting back, I cannot believe some of the bossy, prideful conversations I've had with a holy, righteous God. I did not walk in reverence to him, that is for sure. That God met me where I was. My addiction made me feel powerful, in control. But the step one reality is that I was powerless. My desire to hang on to my addiction was a barrier to God being able to work in my life. God could not be my physician as long as I was self-medicating. Jesus really wanted to be everything to me, and I needed to let him. I surrendered myself not to just one person, but a sponsor and 3 accountability partners. I began surrendering my life and will to Christ. Principle 3 states consciously choose to commit all my life and will to Christ's care and control. Instead of disassociating and having a secret life, I began to shed that life, letting the barrier come down between my real self and my fantasy self, and seeing the room swept clean. But I needed to fill that room with something. Last time it was white knuckling. This time, it's real relationships with God and people. I was more honest with myself and my sponsor. 2 months after my sobriety date, I told her that I missed my behavior. She suggested Play-Doh, something tactile to do until the cravings passed. I used that for 4 months and still keep a tub by my bed to remind myself how helpful that was. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, "No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with temptation he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it." God gives us a way out. This road of recovery is the way out. On prayer cards, I had put my contact information. People began texting me and referring to me as their sister in Christ. At first, it felt too intimate, and I was frightened. But I started letting God restore me to sanity. As long as I am focused on God first and working my own recovery, I can enjoy these relationships. I used to be hypervigilant about triggers. Now I know we live in a fallen world and triggers will come. But I no longer need to respond to them other than to tell myself to let it pass or let that thought go. Except for The Passion of the Christ, I don't watch any R-rated movies as I don't want to be surprised or unprepared. I am quicker to stop following a trail of soft porn that might appear at the bottom of a news story on my tablet. God has given me back my life, and I feel empowered, not in my own strength, but through the power of the Holy Spirit. My life is more manageable. Day by day, I am believing in who Christ says I am, not my ex-husband's or someone else's opinion of me. I now know that I was believing a lie. In truth, I did not deserve to be assaulted or punished by my husband because of my own sins. Christ knows the truth of who he made me to be. The more I turn my life over to him, the more I understand that truth. I am more consistently walking in obedience, aligning myself with his will. I can truly say today that Jesus Christ is everything to me. The triune God is enough. I don't need anything else except to treasure the people that he has put in my life. There is a peace and contentment that's come over my life that I had never experienced before. And it is real, not the fake contentment of addiction that is short-lived. One of my favorite words is joy. I have joy in giving another a word of encouragement and reaching for another's hand or giving another a hug, and I am no longer frightened. But I am mindful of our adversary, and therefore I am on guard about pride. James 4:10 says, "Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up." I used to think after completing step study, I had arrived, like I had completed the 30-yard dash and game over. But now I understand that recovery is an 80 or 90 or 100-year marathon, depending on how long we live, and the finish line is heaven and not before that. Recovery takes a little work each day, reading scripture, praying, journaling, working the steps, attending meetings, but it is worth it. For the newcomer here, this is a healing place. Jesus Christ, the great physician, will meet you here. Hope is here. Recovery is here. We did not get to this point overnight, and healing will take time, persistence, patience, and faith, but it will happen. I pray that you will join us as we walk this road of recovery together toward our final victory in heaven. To God be the glory. Amen.